and thrilled to be back in this chair today with you on Focus on WJR, sitting in for Paul W. Smith. I am Dave Llewellyn, longtime sports news anchor at Channel 7. We'll talk some media today during the next couple of hours as you stay with us on Focus. A great lineup of guests today, some interesting topics as well, and look forward to all of it ahead in the minutes and the couple of hours that we have together today. First, though, as usual, we want to bring in producer extraordinaire Mike Parsons to talk about some of the news of the day. Mike, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, legendary broadcaster Dave Llewellyn.
Well, you're too kind with that.
Award-winning podcaster now, by the way. Congratulations.
That's right, the Dave Llewellyn Podcast on YouTube, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and on, I'm thrilled to say, thegreatvoice.com. And that is a real thrill for me as well. Every couple of weeks, we come out with new podcasts. We've had Gregory Kelser on recently, Alan Trammell, but it's not just sports and sports stories. There's news and nonprofits, people making a difference in our community. We'll talk to some of those folks today during Focus as well. But to the business at hand, Mike Parsons, and I want to begin with the UFC fight that's coming up June 14th at the White House.
Wow.
And the ridiculous structure that has been built on the south lawn of the White House. They're calling it the Claw. It's 90 feet tall, and that's to support lights and cameras and all for the UFC cage fight that will take place on the grounds of the White House. President Trump even saying he likes that structure.
Right.
And may want to keep it even after the June 14th event.
Yeah, Dave, when I first saw a picture of this contraption that you're describing, I thought it was AI. I thought there's no way that's real. And, you know, here's the thing. I take President Trump at his word. I'm sure he would like to keep it up permanently. And I'm sure the next president will take it down probably within a week of being inaugurated.
Well, I would certainly hope it doesn't stay. I mean, to me, it's an awful-looking structure.
Yeah.
It's 90 feet tall. It overshadows the White House. I mean, who wants the White House overshadowed by some ugly structure?
I mean,
that's my view.
Could you imagine being like a school group on a field trip trying to get a picture of the White House and you got to shoot around that thing?
Well, and he's already demolished the East Wing, right, to build the big ballroom. It's like... it's a construction zone.
Yeah, and then also I think there's that, I don't know where they stand with that, the giant Arc de Trump, which is supposed to be bigger than the one in Paris. But yeah, I mean, I was hoping they wouldn't build this thing in the first place, but I definitely hope it's not permanent because it is quite an eyesore.
And if you haven't seen it yet, I would encourage you to go online and search for it. I mean, it's that.
You're right. It looks like a giant claw machine. So, that's only 10 days away. Is it just one fight, or is it like an entire undercard that's happening?
You know, that I'm not sure about. Yeah. I won't be watching.
I don't think I will either.
But I am sure there will be people who will choose to watch. All right, let's talk about another structure closer to home here, and we're talking about the new bridge connecting Canada and the United States. It is nearing completion. President Trump, speaking of the president, had demanded concessions for Canada, said we might not let this new bridge, which has been funded by Canada, open unless we get concessions. Anyway, construction is... wrapping up, Customs and Border Protection staff told the Senate during a hearing that we're ready to go with staffing, but there's no green light at this point. Maybe spring of 2027 if they resolve this, but it's a big deal for us here and across the river in Windsor.
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. And I mean – To me, I feel like having Canada fund this whole thing and then they're able to recoup their costs after it opens, I thought that was a pretty good deal to begin with. I mean, and it seems like, you know, this is the result of bipartisan work by Democrat and Republican governors, legislators over the years. And as far as I know, right now, most of the delays are construction related. And I hope any delays after that, there's no more delays when it comes to the president trying to block this, because this is going to be, I mean, it's a trade issue. Right. I mean, right now you've got one bridge and you've got one tunnel. You open up that other bridge and you're not going to see those big lines coming up 75, getting off the Ambassador Bridge exit. And on top of that, I mean, it's going to have a walking path that you can go across. I mean, this is going to be like a really good thing for our region. So I hope this is just tough talk, because, you know, I don't know what else Canada can give us. I mean, they're not going to be too happy about taking even longer to recoup their costs when they fronted the whole thing.
Right. And it's, you know, Canada's our largest trading partner. And despite, you know, the back and forth that we've had with, you know, our government leaders, it's important. It's important for businesses, for trade. It's essential, crucial for our state.
Yeah, and nobody looks good if Canada's mad at you. I mean, if Canada's mad at you, Canada's like they're like that friend of yours that never gets mad. So if they get really mad, you know you messed up. So we don't want to get to that point.
All right, and one more thing here. And, you know, the Tigers had, after an encouraging couple of weeks to start the season, it's been a slog, but we could say now they're the hottest team in baseball.
Not in last place anymore.
They've won three in a row. They just swept the Rays down in Florida, and they return home now to open a series with Seattle on Friday night, and we may soon see Justin Verlander on the mound finally for the Tigers.
Yeah, he pitched a start down in Toledo, and it sounds like it went really well.
Five scoreless innings, no walks. A very encouraging rehab stint. Tigers aren't saying yet what the plan is for Verlander's return to their lineup and the majors, but, hey, if this is one more piece of encouraging news, we'll take it, right?
Yeah, and the Verlander thing was just supposed to be a nice bonus, a nice addition to an already strong rotation. But you know what? I felt at the beginning of this season that this Tigers team was going to be a roller coaster. I didn't know that it would be 1 month on, 1 month off. But, yeah, all they have to do is go 22-6 in the month of June, and we're back on track.
Well, they're off to a good start in the month, that's for sure. And we're off and running on this Thursday on Focus on WJR. Dave Llewellyn sitting in for Paul W. Smith today. Much more of our show coming right at you following these words. Back on Focus on this Thursday as we get things started. Dave Llewellyn sitting in for Paul W. again today. Pleasure for me to sit in this chair and also to welcome WJR's Marie Osborne with a story of President Donald Trump, who plans to make his acting attorney general a permanent pick now. Marie, what's the latest on this?
Hi there, Dave. So during a private White House dinner, the president told his guests he intends to nominate Todd Blanche to officially lead the Justice Department. That signals big confidence after weeks of informal indications the job was really his. Blanche has been serving in an acting role. It's about 2 months now following the dismissal of the previous Attorney General, Pam Bondi. Blanche, a longtime ally and former personal lawyer to the president, he's worked to solidify his standing inside the administration. Now, this move would formalize a relationship that it's already drawn attention in Washington. Supporters within the White House say Blanche has delivered on key priorities, pointing to aggressive legal actions and policy shifts aimed at crime and fraud. Critics, though, they argue some of these actions suggest the Justice Department is being steered to advance political objectives. So the expected nomination also comes amid a recent controversy. Blanche has faced backlash from some of the same Republican senators he needs for confirmation after he pushed for plans for a $1.8 billion fund that would have paid out Trump followers and allies who alleged political persecution by the prior administrations. And this is an idea that was ultimately dropped, though, after resistance from lawmakers. So, Dave, now we're just waiting for the formal submission. Blanche's nomination would set up what could be a closely watched confirmation hearing on Capitol Hill.
Well, clearly, being his defense attorney previously, I mean, he is a Trump loyalist, and there, you know, that is a concern to many, certainly in Washington, that there is another Trump loyalist running a department, and in this case, the Justice Department. Yes, there is going to be scrutiny over this.
It is going to be a confirmation fight, as they say. But as you and I both know, our listeners know, one thing that this president really values is loyalty. When you look at who's in his cabinet, the types of appointments he's made, the kinds of people that he surrounds himself with, it really is, number one is loyalty. So not a surprise here. Like you said, this was his defense attorney, so he obviously had full confidence in him.
Well, and, you know, this is just the latest in a line of choices, of selections that the president has made as well. Bill Pulte, Michigan
yes.
Man, also now being put in charge of intelligence on an interim basis. Without really any background there. But he has also, in his time in the administration, proven to be a Trump loyalist. And those are individuals who get ahead in this administration.
Right. And also, let's just put a word in on this side of the argument. And that is that oftentimes, people who are out-of-the-box picks sometimes turn out to be really good picks for things. I think, you know, you've had experience where you've seen people that, you know, you wonder, wow, they don't have any experience doing that. But then they turn out to be good leaders. So I think this is how the president thinks, is that, first of all, loyalty. And second of all, you got to think outside the box. And maybe that's why he picks some of these individuals.
Well, and the pushback on the $1.8 billion fund.
Oh, yes.
That certainly is in the case of Blanche now. That's going to be, you know, he's going to be grilled about that in any confirmation hearing. And while it appears as though Congress is saying, we're not going there, I don't think from what I read that President Trump necessarily feels that that's a dead issue. So we'll see on that, too.
Yep, and lots of Republicans have confronted Blanche himself about that fund, so they weren't afraid to speak up on this. So, and obviously, Democrats are going to give him a big pushback on, even that idea that could have gone forward.
You know, something else that is going to make these confirmation hearings interesting, and I forgot who said it on our show. I wish I could give him credit, but there is a big group now of sitting Republican congresspeople who Donald Trump got primaried, and they still have 6 months left, and there's still a lot of votes to be had between now and the end of their terms.
How true, right? Yeah, because he definitely did not support some of those people, so that's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, Senator Cornyn, Texas, yep. For instance, just
very
won.
Powerful,
right?
Yes,
and he has become, in particular, very active in speaking his mind now, more so than he did before.
What do you know?
What do you know? Yeah, exactly. So it's going to be interesting times, Mike, as you say, and Marie as well. And a lot of people will be watching the confirmation hearings very, very closely indeed.
Yeah, you mentioned Bill Pulte. I feel like that's going to be another tough confirmation because...
If it makes it that far,
yeah,
right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. Because, a lot of people are like, all right, well, maybe putting him in charge of housing, which I think he is doing something with housing with the current administration.
Yes.
That makes sense. But national intelligence, like, how does that translate?
Right. Has no experience in national intelligence
right.
at all. And again, he may be a fabulous manager, but... in terms of confidence, you'd think you would want accomplished people in a position so critical to, you know, our nation's safety right. and security.
Right. No. National intelligence. Right.
Right. And some of these jobs, I mean, again, the thinking outside the box, I kind of, you know, I buy into that to some degree. Mm-hmm. But in some of these jobs, definitely you have to have the credentials.
We will be watching
very
closely.
You bet.
For sure. In terms of how this unfolds, the timeline for that, and whether or not, you know, this individual, Blanche, can receive affirmative votes in the confirmation process. Marie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marie Osborne, Director of Community Affairs and News at WJR.
Yeah, the other thing that's interesting here, Dave, is mm-hmm. that it seemed like, you know, for the first year, the cabinet seemed to stay pretty much intact. And you're like, okay, well, maybe we're not going to kind of see the revolving door that we saw in the first term. And then since then, Gabbard, even though she wasn't let go, she left on her own. And then there's a few others that I can't remember, but it seems like, a lot of them are, it's just like dominoes almost.
A good amount of turnover for sure. And turmoil. And speaking of that, it's happening with CBS as well and 60 Minutes, much in the news these days. And we'll talk about that as we continue on Focus on WJR on this Thursday. Thrilled to be here today for Paul W. You know, CBS is the network of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite, but it is a time of turmoil within the network, to be sure. And a lot has been written and said about the recent firings at 60 Minutes, including the termination for cause of 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley. Bill Carey has had a long run as a TV news executive. He was my boss at Channel 7 from 2000 to 2004. Before that, served as news director at CBS-owned stations, WCBS in New York and WBBM in Chicago. He's still active in media and brings a unique perspective to the conversation with the history and understanding of the culture of CBS. We welcome Bill Carey to WJR. Bill, good to catch up with you.
Good to hear your voice, Dave, and good to be reunited on WJR.
So what do you make, big picture, because, again, you know the history of CBS and the culture. You know it well. What's happening right now to the network with Paramount, CBS, and, you know, Barry Weiss being put in charge, and what's going on with 60 Minutes? What do you make of this?
Well, it's unfortunate that so much of it is public. For somebody that is loyal to CBS, just for everybody's sake, I started at CBS in 1979 in an entry-level job, which afforded me the chance to be in spots where I would see Don Hewitt and Mike Wallace arguing loudly with each other and always about the work, and then break and go out for lunch together an hour or two later. It was different times, and people were passionate about their jobs. That's not to say people are not passionate now, but things have changed, and the pressures are different. I don't think that Don Hewitt or Mike Wallace worried too much ever, only on occasion, I guess, about the bosses and the people that owned the company. It was back then it was Bill Paley who founded CBS. Mm-hmm. But they brought a passion and a purpose to their own work where they were their own worst, harshest critics. Certainly Don was, and he would be in on Saturdays and Sundays doing the last minute touches on a show that would be going out to everybody on a Sunday afternoon. And I witnessed that, and it was very important in my own formative years. Fast forward to the 90s, and I came back to the same building, and now I was running Channel 2, which is the flagship station for CBS. And so I had a different perspective, that of a boss that with commingling with the network news operation on different projects, And my perspective on what's going on today is a mixture of both being a staffer and being a boss. And I think that there's enough blame to go around on all sides. And because it is a complicated story, I'll just go into this. One of the big things that changed in that 30,000 foot, take a step back, big picture that you're asking me about is that news was originally part of radio and TV by the founding fathers of broadcasting as a public service. Mm-hmm. And it was a way of showing that they would be responsible, and serving in the public interest meant a lot. And I don't know how many people who are in the business, radio and TV these days, refer to that or look at it the same way as maybe my generation did. By the way, I'm months older than Scott Pelley, so I can feel for him at this point in his career and what's on the line for him and why he might have lashed out. But that leads me to the second thing, which is the people involved. We have a manager that probably, I don't think anybody would argue with this, could have handled things differently mm-hmm. and didn't. Mm-hmm. And we have a rock solid, I mean this, I don't know Scott Pelley well. We worked in the building together. He was a reporter while I was running Channel 2. And I will say that he's the type of guy who would bleed CBS blood if CBS blood had a color. But he is a testament to the legacy of Murrow, which is a big deal in the building. When it was his turn to take on the evening news, he wore that responsibly in the tradition of Cronkite and Rather, and type of guy that might always stay in his suit jacket during the day just because he wanted people to see the right first impression of somebody in his spot.
So Bill,
for him to lash out is a big deal, and I find myself caught up in this story.
Right, right. And for him to do that, he came to the defense of journalism. He came to the defense of 60 Minutes, his colleagues. But you're a manager who's done hiring and firing. The way he handled that in that introductory meeting with the new, executive producer of 60 Minutes, did he cross the line?
Well, let me first say, I don't know all the facts, and I don't know if the recording was done by the managers in the room or by the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And it does make a difference to me. But I will say this without knowing Scott any better than I do. I don't think he would have lashed out if he knew that he was being recorded. I think you have a right to have a closed door meeting with staff, with your management, and have a heated discussion. And I'm smiling as you ask the question, because I don't think that in newsrooms that I ran that something would ever get there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, a new manager is always tested. People want to know if you know how to pronounce local names, and they put you through a crucible to see if you're going to measure up. And that's true, I think, in a lot of businesses, but it's especially true in news. And you have to rise to the occasion. I remember going into Chicago for the first time. I was the managing editor of the CBS station there, and people expected me to know everything geographically and historically, politically about the town, and that's impossible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I was dedicated. I learned. I showed people I was interested in learning. I was able to run that team, and we excelled. And I think if you go in with respect and quell people's concerns, you win people over if you don't have them won over eventually. In Detroit, when I arrived in Detroit, one of my great success stories in my career, I inherited a team that had five bosses in 5 years. I was the fifth. And there was a little bit of shell shock going on. And to my everlasting credit, I didn't make a lot of changes. I settled the place down, and I had people starting to believe in themselves again, and we excelled. I don't think that the current management and ownership has approached the CBS News legacy or the people in the building with the right respect. And so who's at fault? I always blame managers at fault because they're the leaders and they're the ones that you have to look to first. And if they're not doing it right, you can't expect the staff to do it right. So I don't think Scott would have lashed out as he did, but what he did and how he did it was ugly, no doubt about it, but it should never have come to that. I had a quick story here, if you don't mind.
Well, I'm going to have to cut it short, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But no,
sorry
I appreciate that and your time today and the perspective that you bring to this with your long history and experience. Bill Carey, former news director, WXYZ here in Detroit, and also at the CBS-owned stations in New York and Chicago, joining us on Focus today. Bill, I enjoyed this. We'll catch up again soon, I hope.
Great. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you,
Appreciate
Bill.
It.
Bill Carey joining us on Focus today on WJR. Back with much more after this. And we continue on Focus on this Thursday. This is Dave Llewellyn sitting in for Paul W. Smith today and happy to be here and happy to tell you about WJR's Tim McGraw VIP experience. Your chance to rock when country music legend Tim McGraw brings his Pawn Show guitar tour to Pine Knob Music Theater on August 28th. You could win a pair of premium pavilion tickets, transportation courtesy of MetroCars, and $100 to Buddy's Pizza. Now to enter, download the free WJR mobile app, find the secret keyword, then text it to 800-859-0957. And for more info on this, visit WJR.com. Matt Friedman is co-owner of Tanner Friedman Public Relations. He is heard frequently on these airwaves and returns today in his role as a member of the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame Board of Directors to discuss this year's ballot and share how all of you can help decide which of the many deserving names on this year's ballot become the new class of inductees. Matt, welcome.
Dave, thank you. Great to hear your voice on the radio and great to be talking with you about one of my passions here around Michigan, which is honoring our sports history. It's really something.
Well, congratulations on the work you do there. And I'm honored to be a part of the task force committee, which helps determine which names should appear on the ballot each year. Let's talk about, you know, the fact that our listeners, the public, has an opportunity as well to weigh in, to vote online, to make sure that their favorites on the ballot are elected to the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame. Take us through that.
It's something really special that we do here in Michigan. Our board of the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame over the last decade or so has tried to tweak our processes to make sure that we're really honoring every year the best of Michigan sports and the people who deserve to be remembered forever. From across the state, from across the variety of sports, we're talking about men and women and boys and girls who've accomplished amazing things. And one of the ways that we've tried to assure that we do that is by getting fans involved, getting the public involved. So 20% of the votes go to the fans to decide who's going to be inducted each year. And through next week, fans have a chance to go on to MichiganSportsHOF.org, MichiganSportsHOF, like Hall of Fame.org, and vote for amateur athletes from the state of Michigan, professional athletes from the state of Michigan.
Friday's Mega Millions jackpot
coaches,
is $368 million. Dollars.
Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, coaches, media, contributors. The fans have a chance to vote for all of the categories who will be inducting on December 17th at the Motor City Soundboard in Detroit.
So we have 10 amateurs. We've got Olympians and others who have accomplished tremendous things, as you have said. As an example, Steve Avery, the former major league pitcher. Judy Brown Clark, Michigan State, Olympic medal winner. Connie Paris-Kevin Young, cycler, speed skater, also an Olympian. Peter Vanderkay won gold medals. On the professional side, Swin Cash, who led the Shock to WNBA titles. Mark the Bird Fidrich. Kevin Glover, ex of the Lions, one of the great offensive linemen. Pepper Johnson from Detroit, great linebacker, won Super Bowls with the New York Giants. coaches. Tony Anise, who's had an incredible run at Ferris State in football, winning national championships 3 of the last 4 years. Jim Reynolds, who had an outstanding career at Detroit King as well, winning PSL and state championships. On the media side, Al Ackerman, longtime and important figure in television sports in this town. Tim Stout, who is the dean of sports in mid-Michigan, working out of Lansing. John Keating, recently retired, and so long a part of Fox Sports Detroit and FanDuel Sports. Paul Woods, the former Red Wings player, for 40 years, the analyst on the Red Wings radio broadcast. I mean, that's an example of names who are eligible for fans to weigh in and vote their favorites.
Yeah, I recommend that everybody spend some time with the ballot, because all those names you just mentioned, Dave, could be worthy inductees. Not all of them will be. It's going to be, they're going to be some tough decisions. There are also going to be some people on the ballot who maybe you've never heard of, but once you see what their accomplishments are, you might say to yourself, they really deserve to be honored in some sort of memorable and long-lasting way. So I invite everybody to go on to MichiganSportsHOF.org this week, if you can. The ballot closes at the end of next week. And then we'll announce later this summer who's going to be in the class of 2026. And the public is invited to buy tickets and be a part of our celebration and our induction on December 17th at the Motor City Soundboard. And those tickets are available on the website, too.
And that is a wonderful evening as well, because typically all of the inductees are there. There's a reception beforehand for those who, you know, want to engage in that as well. And to just hear some of the stories and reflections of these individuals who are receiving this honor, it really is a special night in our town.
It is. I mean, you'll hear stories you've never heard before about some of your heroes or those who should be heroes. At the same time, just to be in the same room as some of these people and see them and hear them and have them spend the evening with you is something that few fans get the opportunity to do. But at the Hall of Fame, we're able to convene these people, celebrate them, but also give access to the event too.
Well, and you go onto the website, as you mentioned, to vote, but also it lists all of the previous Hall of Fame inductees. And it is a who's who of Michigan sports history, which is what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, we've decided to put as much online as we possibly can so that you don't have to pay to go to a museum to relive some great memories, but also teach the next generation about who some of these people are and what their accomplishments are. It's all online. You can click through it. You can see it. You can experience it. Photos and bios. At the same time, we're also collecting memorabilia as much as we can from our inductees, and the hope is to have that available and accessible online too.
Appreciate this, Matt. Again, through next week, through June 12th, voting, the public voting for the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame. Go to the website, do vote, have a voice in who is honored next of all of these deserving nominees. Matt Friedman joining us today on Focus on WJR, and we'll continue with more. And happy to be here today with you for Paul W. Smith on the Focus Show on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR. We've covered some ground already, much more ahead in the next hour, and we want to begin with one of the issues percolating certainly in the nation's capital. After four House Republicans sided with Democrats to demand that President Trump withdraw U.S. forces from Iran or win approval from Congress. And of course, the president has repeatedly said he does not need congressional authorization to continue the conflict. We want to get some insight, perspective on this from Rocky Rachkowski, the retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. He joins us now on Focus on WJR on this Thursday. Rocky, how are you?
Hey, great. And great to be on with you, David.
Thank you so much. So what's your take on what's happening now? President Trump has pretty much gotten his way with much of what he's wanted to get done with Congress. But there's certainly some pushback, it seems, developing here. What's your take?
Well, a little bit of pushback from four Republicans that actually crossed over the line. One of them happens to be from Michigan. And if you look at the vote, it was 215 to 208, and it happened yesterday. And it sent a message to the White House. But the problem here is twofold. One is, does Congress truly have a war powers resolution responsibility? And this resolution basically says that the president should withdraw military operations and military activity away from Iran unless he gets congressional approval. And obviously, he hasn't had congressional approval.
Right.
The war powers resolution that Nixon worked under and other presidents worked under back from 1973 actually said that the president had X amount of days, usually about 60 to 90 days of operations that they could maintain using the military before they had to pull back. So obviously, this is a message because a lot of our politicians are looking at the next election instead of the next generation. And the president's administration is saying we need to look at this from an understanding that we're dealing with a regime that knows and is counting on this regime in Iran is counting on the president losing the midterms. Let's be honest. Let's put the 800-pound gorilla out there and say that this regime in Iran wants President Trump to lose the midterms. And are the Democrats and these individuals that voted against the president sending a message to Iran that play the waiting game on these negotiations? And if you play the waiting game, you'll be rewarded. And that's the issue that we're facing.
There are polls that indicate, though, that Americans are growing weary of a war there, the conflict there, and our involvement in it. I don't know how that's weighing on the president with poll ratings so important to him, historically, coupled with, the vote in Congress. But it's what you deal with, right? in a leadership
politically.
Role. Politically.
Yeah. Politically speaking, Dave, you're absolutely correct. The president's looking at the midterms, but at the same time, he's basically come out and said, and the way he's, endorsing challengers to incumbents and beating incumbents in specific races that may be more difficult. And the key one, not the Louisiana one where you saw Bill Cassidy lose to a Trump-endorsed candidate for U.S. Senate, because Louisiana most likely will go Republican. But you look at Texas now, and Texas may actually be in play because Senator Cornyn, right, a longtime U.S. senator, very well liked by many people in Texas, lost to their attorney general, Paxton. And now when you look at what will happen after the midterms, when the midterms you have that lame duck period, can the president still count on Republicans to if the Democrats win the Senate or win the House, can the president count on those lame duck representatives that are gone or that he endorsed against and worked against them winning their elections? Can he count on them to hold the line and give him some cover before the Democrats take over and start holding hearings on the Iran war and everything else inside this administration? So yeah, the president has that in his rearview mirror or in his front mirror. But when you look at what the president has said publicly, and quite frankly, if you're asking my opinion is I think he's absolutely correct. We need to stop looking at the next election and start looking at the next generation and make sure that we stop kicking the can down the road with Iran and make sure that they never have any type of enriched uranium, because now we know for a fact that over the period of Bush, Obama, and Biden, and including Trump's first term, they have enriched uranium.
Well, and that's dangerous. Unfortunately, to this point, with this conflict, any talk of resolution, it seems like, maybe we're making progress, but nope. Taking a step forward and a couple steps back. So this is ongoing on the battlefield, if you will, but also in terms of negotiations.
You're absolutely right, Dave, and it is negotiations. But I guess back and being a student of history of war and what has gotten us into war. I still support what General Keane, a former vice chief of staff of the Army, General Keith Kellogg, one of our former special operations commanders and NSC, National Security Council members for the vice president, for the president in the past, what these gentlemen have taken the position on, and that is that this regime in Iran and now the IRGC, Revolutionary Guard in Iran, are so extreme, and they know how to play and wait out the Americans. Mm-hmm. And that is our Achilles heel. As a safe and free society, we always have to bail. We also always have to have the blind scales of justice and weigh, are we doing things publicly and transparently through Congress and getting the authorization, a republic authorization from Congress to go into war? Or are we giving our enemy an opportunity to understand that how they can negotiate with us and get the upper hand? And in this situation, the president is I got to tell you, as much as people may like him or may find him distasteful, he has truly done a great job of balancing this and balancing between Iran as well as the United States, as well as Israel and Lebanon with what we've seen yesterday. Because one of the key issues here is how Israel has been dealing with Lebanon to eradicate Hezbollah outside of southern Lebanon. Yeah. And the Lebanese government and the Israeli government now have a ceasefire with specific agreement on how Hezbollah will be treated. So you got to, whatever you say or whatever you think about this president, you got to tip your hat to his administration on what he's doing in the Middle East.
There is plenty on his plate, that is for sure. Rocky Rutschkowski, thank you so much. Retired Lieutenant Colonel in the U.S. Army joining us on Focus on WJR to discuss this important issue in our country. Rocky, thank you, and we're back with more.
Thanks.
After this. Tomorrow is National Donut Day. That's always a good thing, right? Well, it's tomorrow, Friday, and to celebrate National Donut Day, there is a second location of Detroit's iconic Dutch Girl Donuts opening in the new center area. And the owner of Dutch Girl Donuts, Patty Lynch, joining me today on Focus on WJR. Patty, welcome. And what a way to make an entrance with location number two.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, we're excited. We're not ready for the shop to be officially open full-time, probably about a month away. But with the National Donut Day coming up tomorrow, I thought, not unlike what we did 2 years ago on Woodward, I'm like, let's give everybody a sneak peek, do a little preview, give some donuts away, celebrate the new space on East Grand Boulevard. And we're looking forward to it from 8 to 10.
All right. And not only are you given a sneak peek, but my understanding is between the hours of what, 8 and 10 a.m., a couple of free donuts too?
Yep, two free donuts for anyone who shows up. And then we'll have some dozens boxed already, just like assorted dozens, that if anybody wants to buy a box of donuts to take to work or to their family or whatever to celebrate the day, we'll have those available for purchase. But two free donuts, two complimentary donuts for anybody who shows up between 8 and 10 to see the new space.
And the address is 2820 East Grand Boulevard.
The address is 2820 East Grand Boulevard,
right,
just west of I-75.
All right, so the original location's on Woodward, of course. The business closed, but you bought the business and reopened it. Dates back to 1947. It's one of the growing businesses in your business portfolio. Why the affinity for, why the decision originally to bring back Dutch Girl Donuts?
Well, like so many Detroiters, I grew up on Dutch Girl. My dad started going there in the 60s and 70s when he was dating my mom, who went to Marygrove. And so, you know, when I came along, anytime we were up and down Woodward Avenue, we were stopping at Dutch Girl. And then it became part of my daily commute to the funeral home And so I'd stop in there often to get donuts for, you know, my coworkers. And when it closed, you know, a couple of years ago, like so many people, I was just devastated. And, you know, I had some connections to the family through my cousin, another funeral director, who had actually handled funeral services for them and had grown up with them. And he connected us. And, you know, I wrote him a nice letter and I said, I'd really like to bring it back and pretty much keep it the same. Mm-hmm. And all three donut makers that were there when they closed came back. And so it's been a great 2 years. It's just over 2 years now that we reopened Woodward.
And time for a second location.
You know, it's something that we had thought about over the last few years. And it really worked out organically. It's going in the storefront of what's commonly known as Harani Studios. Amin Harani was a famous Detroit photographer on East Grand Boulevard. His son, Ara, is one of my best friends. And the photography business has changed. Ara doesn't need the studio like his dad did. Mm-hmm. His business is much more mobile. He works from home. And so they were looking to sell the building, but I wanted Ara to keep a presence there. So the studio is still operational, but the storefront, which wasn't being used, is where we're putting Dutch Girl. And so it's kind of a win-win for me, for Ara and his family. And it's an opportunity for us to provide Dutch Girl on that very busy commute, East Grand Boulevard, heading to, you know, Wayne State and, you know, Henry Ford Hospital. So we're excited about the new location.
And here to the Fisher Building as well.
And exactly, for all of you guys, exactly.
And the WDJR studios. All right, so Lynch and Sons Funeral Directors, that has been the family business for years and years and years. But we mentioned Dutch Girl Donuts. You have the Schwitz, of course, the bathhouse that you have, that you run now as well. And recently bought Dakota Inn Rathskeller as well, another long-standing, iconic Detroit institution. Man, you're investing in our city.
Yeah, I got a real soft spot, you know, for the multi-generational family businesses. I'm grateful to be a third-generation funeral director. I'm sitting in the funeral home right now. This is where I still come to work every day. And it means a lot to me to be able to work with my father and my aunts and uncles and cousins. And so when you look at Dutch Girl and you look at the Dakota Inn, you know, these were situations where family didn't really have the opportunity to pass it on to another family member. And so they were looking for a potential buyer. And, you know, I have had relationships with these businesses. You know, one thing I tell people is, one of the reasons why I became interested in taking some of them over is because I had a relationship with them and I had some institutional knowledge.
Sure.
And it was meaningful to me personally. So I'm very grateful that in the case of Dutch Girl, the Timmer family, you know, gave me the opportunity to keep it going. Carl Kurtz from the Dakota Inn was the longtime proprietor. His grandfather built it. And I think these businesses and these buildings are part of the fabric of our city's history, and it really makes us, you know, unique. And I'm grateful that I can, you know, do my best to take care of them.
Well, and patrons would agree that it's a good thing that that you've invested, bought, and control, run these businesses now, including Dutch Girl Donuts. So again, the new location, 2820 East Grand Boulevard in the new center area, open tomorrow in order to provide a sneak peek and a couple of free donuts for people who come between 8 a.m. and 10 a.m. as long as supplies last. But you think it'll be a month or so before?
Yeah, I think we're really close. You know, we have to finalize all of our paperwork with the city, which isn't too challenging, and just kind of, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's and button up the space. But our counters are in, our donut cases in, we'll have coffee on. So this is just a nice opportunity to give people a little sneak peek, as you said, a little soft opening, celebrate National Donut Day, let people pick up some donuts for their friends and family and coworkers. And, you know, and Ara Harani himself will be there. and his father's legacy is really important in that building. So, you know, it's all good stuff, and really excited for the new location.
Yeah, and the donuts are good stuff too.
They're the best. They're the best.
I've had more than a few over the years, and you know, I only wish you were open today as I drive by East Grand Boulevard on my way home. But
Patty, tomorrow.
Patty, thanks so much for this, and good luck with the second Dutch Girl Donuts location. National Donut Day Friday. Best of luck to you.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Patty Lynch.
Bye-bye.
Joining us on Focus Today. Dave Llewellyn in for Paul W. Smith on this Thursday. We're back with more right after these words. Happy to be here today sitting in for Paul W. Following one of my favorite breakfast events of the year, it is the Rainbow Connection Scholarship Breakfast. Rainbow Connection is a wish-granting organization for Michigan kids facing life-threatening illnesses. Ingrid Todd is the executive director of Rainbow Connection. She joins me on the phone now. So we awarded this morning, like we do each year, $1,000 scholarships to former WISH recipients who have graduated from high school, are going on, or are in college. And it is really a fantastic thing, one that I'm, as a member of the board and this committee, am so happy to serve on. Ingrid Todd joins me on the phone now on Focus on WJR. Ingrid, good afternoon to you. And it was spectacular again this morning.
Oh, Dave, it always is. It is one of the most amazing mornings when we celebrate the WISH children that, you know, sometimes we've granted their wish when they were 2, 3, 4 years old. And now they're walking in front of us doing amazing things, leading our youth into the future. And we get to help them. And more importantly, we get to stay connected and, you know, follow their story and their journey throughout their entire career.
We recognize them and celebrate them. We awarded today 25 scholarships, and this is something that Kevin Schneiders, president and CEO of EDSI, has supported in such a major way. We have others who have helped to make this happen on a yearly basis as well with their financial support. And the ability to, you know, to do this for these young people, in some cases, as you mentioned, years after they received their wish, this is what the Rainbow Connection is all about, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the wish is amazing, but more importantly, staying in contact with the families and supporting them through the entire journey, including through the scholarship program, is what, you know, separates the Rainbow Connection from everyone else. We feel that, you know, we want them to find a friend in the Rainbow Connection, and we love supporting them and hearing their stories and learning all the things that happen. And since 2005, when the scholarship program began, it's amazing. Over 325 scholarships have been awarded, Dave.
Yeah, we're very, very proud of that. And look, we know the cost of higher education today as well. So anything that can help as part of that is wonderful. But in talking with, you know, the family members, some of the recipients, they so appreciate the fact that, you know, the Rainbow Connection is still a part of their lives. And there are instances where these young people are now giving back to the Rainbow Connection.
Absolutely, in many ways. Additionally, it's very interesting. A lot of the children go on to do something in the medical field. Because they've been so exposed to it and learned from it. And then they go on to be doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, child life specialists. And it's very incredible to watch and learn. I ran into a young lady we granted a wish for and a scholarship, and she's now at Children's Hospital running the child life specialist. She's a child life specialist there. It's awesome to see.
Give us, for those who maybe don't know, about the Rainbow Connection and the mission of this wonderful Michigan nonprofit, a brief history of the Rainbow Connection. We've mentioned a wish-granting organization for Michigan kids, but there's support for the family throughout all of this, but a brief history.
Of course. So the Rainbow Connection was founded in 1985. To date, we've granted over 4,600 wishes to some amazing and brave Michigan children. However, the wish in and of itself is phenomenal, but we like to stay connected. So we developed programs. One of them, as David mentioned, he and Kevin developed the scholarship program. Additionally, we have something called the Enhancement Program to provide free, fun opportunities to wish families and their siblings and parents to attend sporting events, picnics, holiday parties. And last but not least, very important, we have a special response program. When a family is diagnosed with an illness, they either go from two income to one or one to none, but their bills absolutely remain the same. So we receive grants that can specifically be used to subsidize and help with those bills and take the pressure off while the families and their children are at the hospital fighting for those children.
So for those who are interested in learning more, you know, they can certainly find everything they need to know. And also, if they would choose to support the organization, there's an opportunity to do that online.
Absolutely. RainbowConnection.org is your conduit to see if you want to volunteer, attend an event, donate, drop off some sporting tickets for wish families to use, or just call us or email us. We'd love to give you a tour of our location in Rochester, show you our wish board, and tell you some of the stories of the amazing, brave children that we get to work with every day.
Well, and they are amazing, and the families are amazing. And we know that when there is a child facing issues, challenges, illness, yes, it's the child principally, but it's the entire family that is there, you know, at that moment and also through the journey. And so the families are embraced by Rainbow Connection.
Absolutely. Everyone is impacted, and we love supporting each and every one of them any way possible. That is what we will always do.
So you can support Rainbow Connection. You certainly, there are businesses that that want to get behind the scholarship committee. We'd be happy for that as well. But it is truly one of my favorite mornings of the year, maybe the favorite, the Rainbow Connection Scholarship Breakfast, which we held this morning, awarding 25 scholarships to our former Wish children who are now in higher education pursuits. Ingrid, thank you so much for this. We'll talk soon.
Sounds good, Dave. Thank you so much.
Ingrid Todd is the executive director of Rainbow Connection. RainbowConnection.org is the website with much more information there. And we're back with more on Focus on this Thursday after these messages. And we're back on Focus on WJR on this Thursday, wrapping up this stay. And it's been a pleasure to be here in Paul W's chair once again. Thanks again to Mike Parsons and the great crew behind the scenes here at WDJR. It is a privilege to be here and a privilege to welcome Ryan Ermani, who is coming up following the news on WDJR. Nice to see you.
Davey Lou, it's a pleasure to be with you, my friend. Are you kidding me? The pleasure's all mine.
All right, so let me ask you, you know, this is you know, a one-and-done thing until they call the next time for me, but I've had a blast doing it. You're here every day now. I mean, you got your TV gig as well. Talk to me about the difference between the television and the freedom that you have on the radio side. What do you think?
It is a balance, and it is very different. I will tell you, the television side, it is more, you know, what we do on Good Day Detroit, that you can watch every day from 9 to noon, by the
way. On Fox 2, right?
Fox 2. But we do, it is more of a morning television magazine program. Right. So we are out there, we're having fun, we're in the kitchen, we're making different food items. Like today, we made this cocktail drink. It was great. We had some sips at you know, 9:30 in the morning. It was all good. But the topics that we hit, even we talked earlier today, for I'll give you an example. Jocelyn Benson is not attending the Fox 2 debate tonight. So it's a very serious topic that I think is very interesting and newsworthy. Here, I can spend 30 minutes on that topic. I can do the whole show on that, take calls and everything like that. And I'm by myself, so there is more room to breathe. There, you talk about something for about 4 or 5 minutes. You've got two other co-hosts. So really the science of getting a point in about a minute, minute and a half, without monopolizing the time of the topic, there's a science to that. And the chemistry that I have with my coworkers, I think we're all kind of in line on, hey, here's the topic, here's what we have. We don't want to monopolize all the time, so get your point in and get out. Here you've got a little bit more room.
Well, and room and maybe the opportunity to go in some different directions than what you might decide to do on the TV side.
Absolutely. I am much more opinionated here than I am there on a number of topics. And, you know, there's a number of reasons for that. First and foremost, over there, it is hard to be so opinionated on things when you're basically hitting it and quitting it and moving on.
Right.
So here, when you have more time to explain and breathe, and I think one of the things about a lot of television people that have come over to radio, we are not used to giving our opinion a lot when you're in quote-unquote news.
Right.
Now, I am not a news anchor. I'm more of a news host, and I think that puts me, it gives me more ability to give my opinion on things than to be the traditional news anchor where you are trying to call it down the middle. Now, here, one of the things that I'll always do is I want to get the story right. This is the story. Now, I'll give you my opinion about it, but you better have that story right, and then we can have a discussion about it.
Well, you've got the best of both worlds,
right? Yes, it really is. And, you know, I'm coming up on a year of being here at WJR. July 7th was the first day of the show last year. And I feel like it's gone through some different variations to get to where we are now. I think Beth Ann Long, my producer, and I, we're kind of in a really good groove of where we want it to be.
Yeah.
Today, I have no guests. And
what do you mean, no guests?
Well, there are no guests today. It is me in the audience.
Wow.
And I, like, this is just one of those days where it worked out like that. Now, we did try to get Tom Barrett on with us today because we are going to talk about the president attacking him, calling him unpatriotic, essentially, for voting against the president in the War Powers Resolution. So we did reach out, but he is not able to come on. So we're just going to give our opinion, tell the story, and we'll get some calls about it and have a conversation with the audience. I think that part of this job is really awesome, that you really get to connect with what the viewers, the pulse of the people, essentially, what they think about something. Very unique.
Well, this was where I started. And on the radio side, and so it's always a pleasure to come back, and it's a pleasure to visit with you as well. And, you know, congratulations in advance of the anniversary date that's approaching next month.
I appreciate that. And Davey Lou, you've been an inspiration to me as well. I'm not sure I really ever told you about this, but you were really one of the first guys that transitioned from sports to news. And now that happens all the time, but you're a bit of a trailblazer in that realm. You really were. Now it happens so regularly, but you know, doing that locally here was something that I can't remember had been done before it happened to you. And you were able to make that transition so smoothly and so professionally. And the ability that you had, that you showed people that you can transition and take the career down that path, I thought was remarkable and really opened up a lot of doors for people like me.
Well,
thank you.
Well, you're very kind to say that.
Yeah.
And again, I celebrate your success here and what you've got going. But he has no guests today on Ryan Ermani's show.
Yeah, the guest is the audience.
Yeah.
The guest is the audience.
Each and every day.
Absolutely. And we are going to have a conversation with them. And I want to see, we're going to hit on a couple of things today. We're going to talk about the California election. Why is it taking so long to count these ballots? Is it complete dysfunction or is it something else? Now, I think it's dysfunction, which is bad enough. But nonetheless, our systems have to be better. The gas-powered leaf blowers in Ann Arbor have been banned. And the Ann Arbor police put a post out that said, if you have a neighbor that is using gas-powered leaf blowers, you can report them to us. So they're almost asking you to snitch on your neighbor. What's going on with that? And we'll talk, of course, I mentioned about Tom Barrett as well, voting against the president.
Stay tuned. All of that and more coming up on JR this afternoon. Ryan Ermotti.
Davey Lou, quickly, are the Tigers going to make a run?
Well, aren't they the hottest team in baseball?
Let's go, baby. Tigers, baby. Come on.
Ryan Ermotti, he's coming up after the news on JR. My pleasure to sit in today for Paul W. Smith. Look forward to doing it again one of these days soon. Have a great rest of your Thursday.